KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The Environmental Protection Agency proposed a new rule for greenhouse gases. It says there's no limit to their emissions from some fossil fuel power plants. What are the consequences? We'll ask on Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we hear a Republican proposal to deny funds to cities defined as lawless. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It comes from Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina, who will take our questions. Also, we remember Brian Wilson, who composed the Beach Boys' joyous music even while living a troubled life. It's Thursday, June 12th. This day in 1974, Little League Baseball said it was deferring to the changing social climate and courtroom defeats and would allow girls to play on its teams. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Authorities are searching for any survivors of the Air India crash in western India today. 242 people were aboard, and it has not been confirmed if anyone survived. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Mumbai. The plane crashed almost immediately after takeoff.
Footage aired by a local outlet here called Press Trust of India showed the plane sinking over a residential quarter of the western Indian city of Ahmedabad. And then there was just a ball of fire.
NPR's Dia Hadid reporting. The jet is a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. The National Transportation Safety Board is sending a U.S. team to help in the investigation. An overnight curfew expired earlier today in Los Angeles. It's intended to reduce the number of confrontations between police and demonstrators protesting federal immigration raids. Steve Futterman reports.
The sounds of downtown L.A. during the curfew. Vehicles are on the road, but for a second night, no protesters. City officials say the curfew is reducing tensions, reducing but not eliminating. Wednesday night, just before the curfew began, protesters battled with police right near City Hall. The police, some on horseback, used flashbangs to disperse the crowd, and there were arrests. Another group opposing the Trump administration's immigration policies gathered outside the curfew zone near LA's Koreatown. Law enforcement ordered them to leave. When they didn't, there were additional arrests. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
A federal judge says he could order Mahmoud Khalil released from federal custody as soon as this week. The State Department is trying to deport the former Columbia University graduate student over his pro-Palestinian activism. NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
Khalil's lawyers have been arguing that Secretary of State Marco Rubio's decision to deport Khalil because of his activism was an unconstitutional violation of his right to free speech. Last month, Judge Michael Farbiars ruled that Khalil is likely to prevail in court on that argument. And because of that, the judge has now ruled that the government cannot keep Khalil detained. But he gave the government until Friday to appeal, so it's not clear when Khalil might be released. It's nonetheless a huge victory for Khalil. He's been at a detention center in rural Louisiana since ICE agents arrested him in New York 3 months ago as part of President Trump's crackdown on student protesters. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
The UN's nuclear watchdog agency says Iran is out of compliance with its nuclear obligations. The finding by the IAEA could trigger new international sanctions against Iran. The Iranian government has responded. Officials in Tehran say they will create a new uranium enrichment facility in a secure location. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court has released several decisions this morning. In one, the justices ruled unanimously that a family whose house was wrongly raided by law enforcement can sue them. Officers in Atlanta had raided a family home by mistake. They were trying to serve an arrest warrant for a neighbor. In another unanimous case, the justices ruled for a Minnesota student with a disability. The high court said that the student's parents do not have to show that the Minnesota school district acted in bad faith when they brought their discrimination case. Former BET host and MTV VJ Ananda Lewis has died from breast cancer, according to her family. NPR's Kristen Wright reports Lewis became well-known to a generation of young people in the 1990s.
Ananda Lewis was one of the early hosts of BET's Teen Summit. With a live studio audience, she delved into important social issues affecting young Black people. Lewis then became a presence on MTV as a host and VJ of popular shows, including Total Request Live and Hot Zone. She later hosted her own syndicated talk show. Lewis shared her stage 3 breast cancer diagnosis on Instagram in 2020 and said she regretted not getting checked earlier.
Right now, you have the opportunity to make a different choice. Call your doctor, call whoever the hell you need to call to get your mammogram scheduled, and then show up for it, and then do it.
Lewis was also open about her decision to follow alternative treatments. She was 52. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Coming up, what are the new rules for fossil fuel power plants? First, Los Angeles spent another night with a curfew in part of the city. It's been quieter than in recent days when protesters against the president's immigration enforcement threw rocks and burned cars. President Trump sent in the California National Guard and the Marines. Protests have spread to other cities such as Dallas, Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. The defense secretary told Congress this week the administration wants to be prepared to send the National Guard elsewhere if needed. And Representative Nancy Mace, our next guest, has proposed legislation to cut federal funding to cities described as lawless. She's a Republican from South Carolina. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, and thank you.
So I've read your proposal. The idea is to cut funding for 180 days, 6 months or so, if a city or state blocks police from stopping riots or defunds law enforcement or rejects federal assistance during widespread violence. Why would that be needed?
Well, I mean, I think we all saw the images in LA this weekend, and we saw Mayor Karen Bass and Governor Gavin Newsom, deny what was happening. And you saw people burning cars in the streets, attacking law enforcement. There was a dead body in the street during massive looting in LA. Sort of like the riots a few years ago where these Antifa folks or Black Lives Matter were trying to burn cities down. Mm-hmm. We just can't have this kind of lawlessness. Like, we have to be a country of laws. People have to follow the law.
Just so we're clear, I mean, we did have some burned cars and so forth. Los Angeles authorities argued that they were on this and in the police were in the streets. Does Los Angeles then, in your opinion, qualify as a lawless city that should have had its funding cut?
Last weekend, if it had continued, I would say yes. But it seems like in the footage from the last 24 to 48 hours, things have calmed down. It is a protest, not a violent riot. They don't seem to be attacking or killing anyone right now or burning things. And that's the way that it should be if you want to protest. You can't be violent in the streets and harm other people or their property, including their cars. And I don't care if it was one car or 100 cars, it's still wrong and it's still violence.
I'm interested in the concept of this bill because you're essentially saying the attorney general would decide a city is lawless or a state is lawless. Effectively, then the president or the president's administration decides that someone is lawless. Would they alone get to decide what that word means?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we have the contours of it in the bill. So, like, if you're a city that sides with rioters or defunds the police or rejects help from the administration, those are the contours that you use to define lawlessness. But, you know, we just can't have this where, you know, there's violence in the streets. They are accepting it as a peaceful protest when it's not, and people are getting harmed or their property is. We need to have tools in the toolbox to be able to say to these cities, no more, this needs to stop. Because what we saw last weekend was a governor and a mayor and others saying, we even had Maxine Waters saying, I was there, this was a peaceful protest. We all know that it was not. And so you just can't gaslight people, can't have violence, you can't hurt their property or hurt their person and just allow it to continue freely. This is not a thing.
One
should
question,
not be a thing.
I got you. One question that I have, though, is whether Congress would provide oversight if a president were to abuse that power. I mean, you could imagine a future president deciding that South Carolina is lawless and cutting off funding to South Carolina. Do you have faith that Congress would provide oversight in that situation? I ask knowing that you're on the House Oversight Committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, oversight, that is our jurisdiction. We have broad oversight powers in that regard. But with regards to South Carolina, we are not going to be a state who sides with rioters. We're not going to be a state who defunds the police. And in fact, we had a sanctuary sheriff last year who lost her election because I communicated with voters what she was doing, letting illegals out who were rapists, murderers, and pedophiles. And she lost her election in a very blue county that Kamala won. So my home state of South Carolina isn't ever going to be a lawless state.
Although you may have a president of the other party.
Well, we could, but I would hope that a president of either party would not allow this to go on. We as a people, one of the things I think is wrong with what's happening in our country now, the polarization, mm-hmm. is our inability to recognize the truth or recognize the problem. I mean, you literally had media last weekend. You had a governor, a mayor, a member of Congress denying what people were seeing with their own eyes on the camera.
Let me just ask very quickly, if I can, in the minute that we mm-hmm. have, you probably know that the president has been accused of lawlessness. A fair number of judges, including his own appointees, have ruled against him for closing agencies that Congress had approved, firing people without notifying Congress as the law required, failing to give due process, on and on. Do you think that oversight is needed in that case?
I don't think he can fire enough people, quite frankly. There are people in the administration and in these agencies and departments who are trying to block his agenda and what he's trying to do, including his executive orders. I would not define where he has not supported violent riots and isn't defunding the police and wants to help the people of California. So I don't consider him lawless.
You don't think that anything that he has done is beyond his authority as president?
I support Donald Trump 100%, and I don't think he can do enough. I think he needs to do more.
Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina, thanks for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Trump administration plans to repeal limits on greenhouse gas pollution from the country's fossil fuel power plants.
These are coal and gas generators, and they are the second largest source of climate heating greenhouse gases behind transportation.
Jeff Brady is here from NPR's Climate Desk with more. Good morning, Jeff.
Hello, Michelle.
So what is the Trump administration proposing?
They are removing any responsibility that fossil fuel power plants have under current rules to help with reining in climate change. If this rule is finalized, there will be no limits on greenhouse gases for existing coal-fired power plants and new gas-fired ones. And this is all part of President Trump's effort to move away from the climate policies of the Biden administration and refocus on exploiting more domestic fossil fuels. Here's Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin at yesterday's announcement.
Rest assured, President Trump is the biggest supporter of clean, beautiful coal. We will use coal for power generation, to mine for critical minerals, and to export to our allies. Today, we are taking an important step towards putting America back on track.
To justify lifting these limits on climate pollution, the EPA argues that U.S. power plants are a small and declining part of global greenhouse gas emissions, around 3%. So the agency argues they're no longer a significant contributor to the problem. But, you know, I recently looked at one analysis that showed if U.S. power plants were a country, they'd be the sixth largest contributor to global climate pollution, really.
So what kind of reaction is this getting from the fossil fuel industry on the one hand and environmental groups on the other?
I talked with Meredith Hankins, an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
This action would be pretty laughable if the stakes weren't so high. This administration is actually trying to argue that the largest industrial source of carbon pollution is somehow insignificant to the problem of climate change.
Hankins and others say the Trump administration is propping up the coal industry at a time when Americans are experiencing the effects of a hotter planet, you know, more intense storms, flooding, heat waves, and wildfires. Coal and gas companies, though, you know, they're big fans of the Trump administration's energy policies, including this one. And like the president, they see opportunity in tapping more of the country's fossil fuel reserves.
And so where does this leave the U.S. in the global fight against climate change?
These power plant rules have gone through a couple of different evolutions. They started with President Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan back in 2015. His administration took that proposal to the United Nations climate meeting in Paris that year to show that the U.S. was serious about addressing greenhouse gas pollution and to encourage other countries to sign the landmark Paris Climate Agreement, which, of course, they did. In that agreement, countries laid out how they're going to reduce their climate pollution to avoid the worst effects of a hotter planet. And Trump is once again removing the U.S. from the Paris Agreement. Repealing these limits on power plants is part of that withdrawal from the global fight against climate change.
So what happens next with these power plant rules that the EPA has proposed?
There's going to be a comment period, maybe a rule by the end of the year. And shortly after that, I suspect they're going to be challenged in court.
That's NPR's Jeff Brady. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump attended the opening show of Les Miserables at the Kennedy Center in D.C. on Wednesday night, attracting supporters and protesters. NPR's Ayanna Archie reports.
A handful of drag performers showed up to the venue in protest to a pledge the president made to put a stop to drag shows there. One such performer was Vagenesis, whose real name is Anderson Wells. She told NPR she had to speak out.
Theater is supposed to be a place of community, a place of storytelling, a place of celebration, joy, catharsis. And it should be open and available to all.
In February, Trump fired the president and chair of the Kennedy Center and board members who were appointed by President Joe Biden. He also gave several people in his circle board seats, including Second Lady Usha Vance and Attorney General Pam Bondi. The new board then appointed Trump as the new chair. Inside the Kennedy Center Wednesday night, some people cheered and others booed at Trump, and chants of USA broke out, according to video posted by the Associated Press. NPR wasn't allowed into the theater during the show. Outside the center, Amy said she didn't agree with the new leadership picks. She did not feel comfortable giving NPR her last name, as she didn't want to bring attention to the organization where she works.
I feel one way about it, frustrated, but at the same time, I didn't want to abandon this institution. It's really important in this country, and so I wasn't willing to not come tonight. The only person that gets hurt is me.
For Elena Hyers, it was worth it. She traveled from North Carolina to get a glimpse of the president.
Always loved it and I see theater or opera when we came, when we travel. So this is one we haven't seen. So it's a plus. We get to see something we haven't seen and see him.
Ayanna Archie, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Benicio del Toro talks about his leading role in Wes Anderson's new film, The Phoenician Scheme. He'll look back on his film career and tell us about losing his mother when he was 9 and moving from Puerto Rico to Pennsylvania in his teens. Del Toro's other films and TV series include The Usual Suspects, Sicario, and Escape from Dannemora. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I wish they all could be California. I wish they all could be California.
We're taking time to remember the songwriter who had that wish, Brian Wilson, who was a genius. That is not my word. Paul McCartney said that about him, and so did Bob Dylan. With the Beach Boys in the 1960s, Brian Wilson elevated the sounds of California surf music with elaborate choral arrangements and orchestral pomp. He also lost decades to mental illness and drug abuse before making a midlife comeback. What a life. His family announced yesterday that he has died at the age of 82, and so we called Brian Wilson biographer Peter Ames Carlin.
In 1962, when the Beach Boys really first began to make records and he emerged as their visionary musically and compositionally, the music around was very simple, but, you know, Brian sort of created this musical palette. The sound is so dense and so full of different instruments being applied in so many unexpected ways. You know, Fun, 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 for instance, which is about a car, you know, he uses baritone saxophones as this low rumble that just sort of evokes this engine without really drawing attention to it. It's just there beneath the surface of the music.
He, of course, is also using a lot of human voices as instruments here.
Yes, he was very inspired by the Four Freshmen, which was a jazz vocal harmony band from the 50s. And he wove his voice and the voices of his brothers, Carl and Dennis, and his cousin Mike Love and Al Jardine, their bandmate, into these incredibly elaborate sort of harmonic constructions that really transformed the sonic vocabulary of rock and roll.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around.
I mean, genius is an overused word, but just given the disparity between the training that he received and what he achieved, just in terms of his ability to, you know, to write arrangements and laying that above this foundation that came straight out of Chuck Berry, you know, just three chord rhythm and blues inspired rock and roll.
You said a disparity between what he did and the training he received. What was that training?
Not much. I mean, I think he took some classes in high school, you know, and learned the basics of theory, but he just had this amazing God-given ability. And, you know, by the time he was 22, 23 years old, he was writing and recording Good Vibrations, which was just jaw-dropping to all the people, you know, even his peers, you know, John Lennon and Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan and all the greats of that era just heard that song and were like, what's even happening here?
Why do you think it is that even as his music was coming together in this way, his life was seemingly coming apart?
Well, you know, he had, you know, along with his musical gifts, he also had, you know, psychiatric trouble. I mean, and for many, many years, he really didn't get any kind of treatment. You know, he self-medicated with drugs or alcohol or food and just anything to get through the days. Eventually, he did get a much more stable family situation and much more competent and professional psychiatric treatment. And once that happened, you know, he had this incredible 30-year coda from the mid-90s into the teens and beyond, where he managed to finish Smile, the sort of legendarily uncompleted sort of rock symphony he started working on in 1966.
A jump of grief, heart hardened eye. Beyond belief, a broken man too tough to cry.
When it finally appeared in 2004, it was astounding that he had found the courage and the strength to go back to this thing he had started and left undone in his early 20s and actually bring it to fruition.
What was it like in those later years for you to talk with him about his life as a biographer?
Well, the way I always described Brian to friends is he's weirder than you can imagine, but not as crazy as you might think. You know, there was a lot about Brian that was quirky and hilarious and strange. He had a way, I mean, this is going to sound kind of weird, but somebody had cautioned me of this before I met him, which is that sometimes Brian knows things about you that you haven't told him yet. A friend of his told me once that they had had a lot of conversations about a particular version of Rhapsody in Blue, the Gershwin piece that Brian was obsessed with, but neither of them had the album. And one day the guy came across it like in a garage sale, and he just had it in his living room and was thinking, I got to give this to Brian. And there was a knock on the door, and Brian was there saying, you got that Gershwin, right? And it was like he said, I can't explain that. I don't know how that happened, but there he was.
What are some kinds of music of today that you think we wouldn't have or wouldn't have in quite the same way were it not for the influence decades ago of Brian Wilson?
I think he left his mark in so many ways, but I think probably primarily it's just his endless fascination with and skill at manipulating different sounds and weaving together different textures and instruments in completely unexpected ways. And his ability to take all these sort of far-flung styles and sounds and weave them together into something that not only made sense, but also was fit in the radio alongside with all the other sort of pop rock hits of the day. You know, it's in some ways, it's almost easier to talk about the styles of music that he didn't influence in pop music. But it just, you know, he just had a very, very deep and very, very broad imprint on popular music.
Peter Ames Carlin wrote a 2006 biography called Catch a Wave, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson, who has died. Mr. Carlin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
A lot of climate pollution in the U.S. comes from buildings and the energy they use.
If we're going to try to really combat climate change, it is looking at the existing buildings in this country.
But upgrading individual homes and businesses to use less energy is costly. So some researchers are asking, what about a whole block at once? More on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The House is set to vote today on more than $9 billion in proposed funding cuts through DOGE actions, including foreign aid and public media funding. Separately, NPR's Corey Turner reports House Republicans are also looking to hold colleges accountable for student loans.
There is pretty broad consensus around the idea that we need some kind of accountability for colleges. But I heard several really key worries about this plan. One of them is that it would require a ton of data, and the Education Department, which would have to collect it, has half the staff that it had before President Trump took office. There's another problem I heard with the math behind these school penalties.
NPR's Corey Turner reporting. The House Oversight Committee's questioning three Democratic governors of states. Many Republican lawmakers have criticized the sanctuary states for immigrants in the U.S. without legal status. They include Minnesota Governor and former vice presidential candidate Tim Walz. In this exchange with committee chair James Comer, Walz said the immigration system had been broken for a long time.
It's one of the reasons why Vice President Harris was advocating so strongly for the bipartisan bill.
Did she mention her role as the border czar any when you all were out campaigning? Or?
Not that I can recall, other than that we talked about the need to pass the bipartisan border legislation that would have done many of the things that, as a governor, I know would have made our jobs easier.
This is NPR News. Several Tesla owners in France are suing the company owned by Elon Musk. They argue the vehicles they bought for environmental reasons are now far-right symbols reinforced by Musk's public behavior on the political stage. They're claiming direct and concrete harm. However, the billionaire CEO says people should be going after the culprits who target the company through various acts of criminal vandalism. A new global survey finds that more than half of people in key U.S. allied nations, including France, the U.K., Germany, and Japan, say they have no confidence in President Trump's leadership in world affairs. But, as NPR's Frank Lampitt tells us, many also view Trump as a strong leader.
People in 15 of 24 countries downgraded their ratings of the U.S., according to the survey by the Pew Research Center. A majority in almost every country surveyed viewed the president as arrogant. Richard Weick runs the Global Attitudes team at Pew. He says many people want the U.S. to be more engaged in solving big problems, such as climate change.
What people want to see is the U.S. kind of using its enormous power to work with other countries. So when the U.S. is going its own way, it's seen more negatively than when it's working with others.
The survey also found that 67% described Trump as a strong leader, and ratings of the U.S. improved in Israel, India, and Turkey. Pew surveyed more than 28,000 people. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Hundreds of migrants have been arrested in Puerto Rico as part of President Trump's immigration crackdown. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran takes us to a Dominican neighborhood on the island where people say they're afraid.
45-year-old construction worker Juan Vega Paredes did not choose the nickname Avocado Man, but now he introduces himself with it.
Yo soy el hombre del aguacate.
He got the nickname after what happened on January 26th. He was on his way to buy some avocados when he was detained by federal immigration agents.
Este es el arbolito que me acuerdo aquí mismo porque
This is the tree. This is exactly where I was detained, says Vega Paredes, in front of a yellow house in Barrio Obrero, a poor working class neighborhood where almost everyone you encounter is Dominican. And so is Vega Paredes, who came to Puerto Rico in 2021. He's married to a U.S. citizen and does not have a criminal record, but he's been living here without legal status. Vega Paredes was picked up by immigration agents who were conducting a big raid in Barrio Obrero, targeting migrants, mostly Dominicans, without legal status. It was Sunday. He was supposed to work. I was tired, so I decided not to go to work, he says. What a Sunday. He ended up being whisked away in an unmarked car. He was detained for nearly 2 months, first at an immigration facility in Miami and later at a federal prison there. Eventually, he was released on a $10,000 immigration bond. He has to check in with ICE next month, and it's unclear what will happen at that meeting. Vega Paredes is one of the nearly 500 immigrants detained by immigration agents in Puerto Rico since Trump took office. According to ICE, about 75% of them are Dominicans. Fewer than 80 people had criminal records. Rebecca González Ramos, a top ICE official in Puerto Rico, says her office does not target Dominicans.
We work based on intelligence, executing either arrest warrants or final orders of deportation.
She says her agents will stop people on the street and might ask them or others around for proof of their legal status. That's why these days the atmosphere is tense in Barrio Obrero. Now we have to carry our immigration documents at all times, says Digna Gomez. She lives in a house overlooking where Vega Paredes was picked up by ICE. She saw the whole thing. It scared her. She's also Dominican, but in the U.S. territory legally. Gomez says she knows of many others being picked up. Like the barber, she says, who hid in a dumpster. Or El Pescador, the fisherman who was arrested down the street with his son. Annette Martinez Orabona is the executive director of ACLU of Puerto Rico. She says ICE operations like this have happened before in Barrio Obrero, but never at this scale.
Barrio Obrero está siendo estigmatizado como comunidad.
Barrio Obrero is being stigmatized as a community, she says, with interventions that happen at all times and agents arresting more people again and again. The ACLU of Puerto Rico is spearheading an alliance between lawyers and the Medical Doctors Guild, whose members are already visiting patients at their homes since many are scared and not going out to receive medical care. Churches in Barrio Obrero, like the San Pablo Methodist Church, are also helping migrants with food and access to legal aid. Across the street from that church is the small tree-lined Plaza Barceló. It's nestled between homes, bars, and places for migrants to send money back to the Dominican Republic. It's the heart of Barrio Obrero, the place where people meet and play dominoes, and where people take a break from work and life's turmoil. Like 61-year-old Susana Rosario. She's Dominican and has a green card now, but she used to live here without legal status. She now works for the city of San Juan as a street sweeper. Barrio Obrero is part of her route.
Y casi no se ve gente, y eso sí ha impactado lo negocio.
She says there's hardly anyone outside these days. The businesses are empty. A few days later, I saw Rosario again at the plaza. She was crying and didn't want to be recorded. Her two Dominican neighbors, good kids as she describes them, were just picked up by ICE at a construction site nearby. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Harvey Weinstein has been convicted again. He was one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, brought down in the Me Too years. He was convicted once of sex crimes, saw that verdict overturned on appeal, and then was tried again. This new verdict comes in a post-Me Too moment with discord among the jury spilling into public view. Ilya Meritz has been covering the trial for NPR. Ilya, good morning.
Good morning.
What were the charges this time?
So Harvey Weinstein was found guilty of criminal sex act in the first degree, one count. He was also found not guilty of another count of criminal sex act in the first degree. Hmm. Those two counts relate to two different encounters with two different women, both in 2006, Both of those women described what happened to them in their own words from the witness stand. It was graphic at times. It was emotional. The jury found one woman's story met the burden of proof. The others did not. Jurors have not yet decided on a third count against Harvey Weinstein, and that is rape in the third degree. So they will continue deliberating that count on orders of the judge.
Interesting. I can't really recall covering a trial where you would have a partial verdict released and then send the jury back to think some more. Why this way?
So very soon after deliberations began, tensions emerged on the jury. Last week, one juror asked to be excused, saying the atmosphere had become really uncomfortable. Then yesterday, the jury foreman told the judge he was concerned for his safety. He suggested that another juror was not accepting of the fact that he had his own opinion and said that juror was yelling at him. The judge at that point said it was time for a cooling off period. He sent them away for lunch, and I think he's hoping that by announcing a partial verdict, this will move things along.
I get it. Well, does any of that tension cast the verdict in doubt?
Harvey Weinstein's lawyers have made over a dozen motions for mistrial throughout this whole proceeding. All of them have been denied. And among other things, they've said they're concerned that jurors may have considered evidence that was not, or information that was not presented at trial. So it seems possible.
Okay. So tell me, where does all this fit in with everything else, this retrial?
Prosecutors started this trial with a disadvantage. They had just three accusers to present to the jury this time, unlike six the last time. So getting a conviction at all, even on just one count, is a victory for them and for the broader Me Too movement. It did feel to many observers like a test of Me Too's continued power. Many accused men have made or are attempting comebacks. Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., Andrew Cuomo, Donald Trump, to name a few. So getting this conviction has to be a relief for prosecutors.
Ilya, thanks so much for the insights. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Ilya Marritz is covering Harvey Weinstein's latest trial for NPR. This is NPR News.
A veteran who served in Afghanistan says the Trump administration is turning its back on Afghans who served the U.S. military during the war. That's next time, Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Paleontologists usually find new dinosaur species by digging up bones. In this case, they found a new species by looking more closely at bones they already had. A paper in the journal Nature says specimens that have long been in a Mongolian museum are a newly discovered ancestor of Tyrannosaurus rex. T-Rex means tyrant lizard king. These older dinos were smaller, so they're Kankulu, dragon prince. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. There's a phrase you might have heard over the last few years on TikTok and money blogs.
This is money dysmorphia.
Money dysmorphia.
Money dysmorphia. Now, money dysmorphia is not a clinical diagnosis. It refers to young Americans now being richer than young people in previous generations. And yet, about 3 in 5 are anxious about their finances. Our colleague Darian Woods at The Indicator looks at why some in Gen Z feel like they're in the economic dumps, even if they're doing okay.
The median income for a 25-year-old is somewhere between $42,000 and $50,000 a year. Millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers all earned significantly less at that age, even accounting for inflation. Young people's wealth is also higher. And yet, a significant portion of young people today feel like they don't have enough. There's student debt, high house prices and inequality, yes, but they don't fully explain this mismatch. Tali Sharrett is a neuroscientist at MIT and University College London. She thinks there are some other factors at play.
In order to be happy and satisfied, we need to see ourselves progressing.
A sense of progression is important, Tali says, because we easily get used to the status quo.
So it might be that you have great things in your life, like an interesting job or a comfortable home, but it brings you less joy on a day-to-day basis because it's been there all the time.
This is called habituation, a fundamental concept in psychology.
And so coming back to the Gen Z kind of idea is that, well, the fact that they have quite a bit doesn't mean that they don't then feel that they need more.
The second reason for young people's financial dissatisfaction, Tali says, is comparison.
They are the generation where social media is a huge thing that they kind of grew up with. Everyone's posting their travels or their whatever. And, you know, half of it is not really an accurate representation of what's true. So now you're comparing yourself to what appears to be your peers. That will definitely have a negative effect.
Tali Sharrett says that the pains of comparison are real.
There's so many studies, and some of this, these are studies that we've conducted that show that people will care more and are happier if they get more rewards, in this case, money, relative to others.
Now, somebody listening into our conversation might say, you two are gaslighting me, that you're essentially saying this is all in your head. What do you have to say to that critique?
I agree. With the fact that what matters is your subjective experience. Here's the thing. If the reason you are anxious and sad and you know, could be potentially lessened by simply not following certain people on social media, maybe having a break from social media. I mean, try to make a change in your habits to see whether as a result, maybe that does have a positive effect.
Tali also points out that dissatisfaction with the status quo can be a powerful driver for change. After all, if we'd stayed happy with how things were thousands of years ago, we might never have left our caves. Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep with a story of a really big rock. The Rock of Gibraltar, which has been the focus of territorial disputes for centuries. Now the European Union, Spain, and Britain have announced a deal to resolve one of them. Here's NPR's Lauren Frere.
Dominating the horizon at the southernmost tip of Europe stands a majestic Jurassic limestone rock.
The Rock of Gibraltar may be physically attached to Spain, but as this tourism video explains, it's been British soil for more than 300 years. The official language is English and currency, the British pound. Gibraltar's economy, though, is linked to EU member Spain. About 15,000 people commute across the border daily. You literally walk across an isthmus that's got an airport runway on it, too. When Britain left the EU 5 years ago, that land bridge became an external EU border. And there was gridlock. Commuters often faced passport checks.
People have sometimes queued for hours.
British Foreign Secretary David Lammy told reporters those gridlock days are now over. People and goods will once again flow freely across that border. This was the last big unresolved issue from Brexit, Lammy says.
A historic solution that I believe is pragmatic and gives the people of Gibraltar the certainty they need.
Certainty that they're still part of the UK, but will also now be part of Europe's visa-free Schengen travel zone.
Este acuerdo marca un antes y un después.
This is a new beginning, Spain's Foreign Minister José Álvarez also told reporters. Entry and exit checks will still happen at Gibraltar's airport and port. The deal still has to be ratified by the British and Spanish parliaments. But officials are calling this a milestone that benefits everyone. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
This week, NPR is talking about solutions for living and building on a hotter planet. Today we go to Florida, where communities are still recovering from two hurricanes intensified by climate change. Jessica Mazaros with WUSF tells us how people are adapting around Tampa Bay.
Steve Papola is touring the wreckage Hurricane Helene left behind on his family's one-story house in Hudson, just north of Tampa. It's along a saltwater canal that connects to the Gulf of Mexico.
So if you look over there, I left the flood line in the garage.
It's hip high, but goes up in other parts of the home. About 4 feet of storm surge pushed through, soaking the drywall, wood floors, and electrical system. Now he's rebuilding.
Well, everything we do is going to be considered what we should or shouldn't do because of flooding.
So Papola is replacing the flooring with tile because floodwaters can't penetrate it.
We're going to raise the outlets to 24 inches.
He estimates all the repairs will cost $145,000. Flood insurance is covering this, but it likely won't cover the price of elevating the actual house once the internal construction is done. Papola is one of at least tens of thousands in Florida reconstructing their homes after last year's storms. They're building to withstand the impacts from climate change, which is raising sea levels and making storms stronger and wetter. Santina Contreras specializes in urban planning at the University of Southern California. She says what these homeowners are doing is called individual adaptation.
There's a lot of ways that communities are on their own doing things to try to work towards building resilience that is kind of centered more on doing maybe smaller scale approaches or things that they can do at the household level.
Like the things Papola is doing, installing tile and raising the electrical outlets. Then there's the larger scale adaptations, like policy changes.
To sort of manage all of the different sorts of risks that are coming.
Take Fort Myers Beach in southwest Florida, for example. Hurricane Ian nearly wiped out the town in 2022. Now, some restaurants and stores there have to flood-proof their buildings if they want to stay at ground level with the tourist foot traffic. Some business owners are planning to just let the water come in.
We're going to open the front door, open the back door, let the water flow through.
This is Jackie Lysak. She's president of the town's Chamber of Commerce.
We've learned if the water flows through, in our case, because we have movement of the water, that mud doesn't stick around.
The idea is to unplug electrical appliances like refrigerators and dishwashers and move them to higher ground, along with any merchandise.
We're calling it plug and play.
Then all that's left in the building is concrete walls and floors and PVC furniture, bars, and decks. That's one solution to hurricanes. But Tampa General Hospital is taking a different approach. The nonprofit sits just 20 feet away from Tampa Bay.
You can see our seawall here, a view of downtown Tampa.
Dustin Pastor is an architect responsible for wrapping a portable wall around the facility. It takes 3 days to set up this wall, which can withstand 9 feet of storm surge and 130 mile an hour winds. The panels protect fuel tanks for the hospital's backup generators. Pastor says the million-dollar Norwegian technology passed the storm surge test when Hurricane Helene sent the water in the bay halfway up the panels.
We could see the risk, you know, in a clearer light and realize that it was worth the money and the effort to make an improvement like that.
Civil engineer Justin Keller thinks about risk a lot. He helps multiple barrier island communities adapt to rising seas from global warming. The roadways there can flood, even on clear, sunny days during a high tide event.
One of the solutions that have been used throughout the country is more or less managed retreat.
Managed retreat means strategically moving people and infrastructure out of risky areas. But for those invested in staying by the water, Keller says it will take elevating homes and the property surrounding them, like garages, driveways, and seawalls. That way, the local governments can then raise the roadways and stormwater infrastructure.
There's no magic solution to make this area hurricane-proof.
Keller says the best thing to do is bring your home up to code. Steve Papola, the homeowner in Hudson, is doing just that. But it's not for him. It's for the next family.
We have decided that once we rehabilitate and the house is put back in order, we're most likely going to sell it.
Papola says his wife has had a lot of weather anxiety since Hurricane Helene. So they're opting for land versus waterfront property. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Mazaros in Hudson, Florida.
We'll have more stories about climate solutions this week on air and online at npr.org/climateweek.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week, Rethinking Home, comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inske.
I like to smoke my old corn pipe, but I've chewed tobacco nearly all my life. Ding, 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 ding. Chew tobacco, chew tobacco, chew tobacco rag. I even like to smoke cigarettes sometimes, but when it comes to dipping, I'll draw the line. Ding, 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 ding. Chew tobacco, chew tobacco, chew tobacco rag. If you chew tobacco, don't spit on the floor. Expect to rain in the cuspidor. Ding, 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 ding. Chew tobacco, chew tobacco, chew tobacco rag.